Good morning. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Fourth Division, the Honorable Justice Mary K. Rochford presiding, case number 21-0478, Charles Muhammad versus Abbott Laboratories.
All right. I'll start again, and I apologize for my technology issues, and I apologize for starting a little bit late. I did also want to let the parties and counsel know that Presiding Justice Reyes extends his apologies for not being here this morning. He had an unexpected situation and conflict occur that required his attention. He will, I assure you, be listening to the audio of the oral arguments. So at this time, I would like counsel, if they would, to please introduce themselves, and starting with the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Milo Lundblad, and I represent the Muhammad plaintiff appellants.
Thank you, counsel. And for the appellee?
Good morning, Your Honor. Stephanie Wittenauer for the appellees, Abbott Laboratories and AbbVie, Inc.
Thank you. So each side will have 20 minutes to present their arguments. And Mr. Lundblad, would you like to reserve some of that time for your rebuttal? And if so, how much time would you like?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Sure. And so if you would like, Mr. Lundblad, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. There are two major issues before the court this morning. One is whether or not the trial judge appropriately granted summary judgment on the basis of judicial estoppel. And then the second one is whether or not this court, if it finds judicial estoppel does not apply, whether or not the decision below should be affirmed based on the inability of plaintiff to prove proximate cause. I'll deal with the judicial estoppel issue first. And again, the issue is actually pretty compact, that under the Seymour versus Collins analysis, the 5-point analysis, that the two questions before the court are prongs one and two, and that is, did the Muhammad plaintiffs take a position in the Northwestern litigation, the case against Northwestern Memorial Hospital and the two doctors, that is factually inconsistent with positions taken in this litigation? And I'd submit that the short answer to that question is no. The defendants have raised two claims of inconsistency between the two cases by the Muhammads. First of all, defendants argue that plaintiffs in the Northwestern litigation claimed that the Northwestern doctors were the sole proximate cause of the plaintiff Quattro, the child who was injured, his condition. And that's simply not true. As the court, I'm sure, law is very clear that a plaintiff in a personal injury case never has a burden of proving that a defendant was the sole proximate cause of the plaintiff's injury. Under the proximate cause instruction and the law, plaintiff only needs to prove that a defendant's conduct was a proximate cause, one proximate cause that can combine with others. And in the Northwestern litigation, there were multiple other factors that could have contributed to the end result of Quattro being exposed to Depakote in utero and being injured. There were other doctors that had weighed in on whether or not Depakote should have been given, including an outside consultant, Dr. Dago. And also there was the elephant or the gorilla in the room of his mother's conduct, Angie's conduct, and that she was the one who was not using birth control properly. So we believe that the plaintiff took a consistent position of only arguing that the defendant doctors at Northwestern were a proximate cause, not a sole proximate cause. So there's no inconsistency there. The second claim by defendants is that they contend that in the Northwestern litigation, plaintiffs claimed that the defendants had enough knowledge to withdraw Depakote and prevent injury. But here we're claiming that they did not have enough knowledge. What I'd like to point out is that in the Northwestern litigation, plaintiff's expert, Dr. Wills, did not offer the opinion that Depakote never should have been prescribed. And her reason for that is because at the time, the literature and the warnings put out by Abbott only said that there was a 1-2% risk of spina bifida if a woman became pregnant while taking Depakote. And Dr. Wills was of the opinion that based on that low risk, that it was reasonable to start Mrs. Muhammad on Depakote. But the situation changed when it became apparent that she was likely to get pregnant because she could not use birth control properly. Now, in this case, the evidence is different in that the evidence shows that Abbott knew that the real risk of Depakote was 10 to 17%. And that information was not disclosed in their labeling. And you know, it is black letter law that in a medical malpractice case that a doctor has to be judged on the knowledge that was available at the time of the treatment. So because the knowledge about the 10 to 17% risk of injury was not known, not in the warnings, then the two doctors had to be judged by the limited information they had, that there was only a 1 to 2% risk, which made their choice initially reasonable. If here, what all the plaintiff is saying is that if the real risk of Depakote had been published and made known by Abbott, then that would have given even more reason for the doctors to have stopped Depakote when it became apparent that Mrs. Muhammad was likely to become pregnant. Or the other thing is that they never would have started the Depakote based on the fact that the risk at 10 to 17% outweighed the benefit. And therefore, they should have considered a less toxic medication such as lithium. So it's our position that we have not taken two factually inconsistent positions, that even based on the knowledge that was available, the doctors could have made the right decision. And had they had the full picture of all the knowledge, then they would have had an even better opportunity to act appropriately. And I'd like to point out, as we did in our-
If I could stop you there and just kind of clarify, I don't know that I got that second part as clearly from your briefs. I thought the allegations here are that if they had full knowledge, they would never have prescribed it in the first place. But now you're saying there's a second part that it would have given more support for an allegation that they should have stopped it. So is there two parts to this?
No, that's exactly correct. I mean, we believe that if the doctors, if in 2005, that the full risk was known of 10 to 17%, then the doctor should have made a different choice and never prescribed it. However, I believe that it follows and was argued in the brief that if the risk, published risk was known to be higher, that it would have given even more reason for the two doctors to stop Depakote in June, right after it had started when they had the pregnancy scare, and that there would have been even more reason for them to have switched. That is, you know, as the doctors acknowledged in their depositions that this whole thing, their decisions are based on a weighing of risk versus benefits. And at because of the limited knowledge they had due to the improper warning, the risk was that of 1 to 2% as opposed to 10 to 17%. And if the real risk had been known and then put into the equation, that the risk side of the scale would have tipped against giving Depakote or stopping Depakote after the pregnancy scare. So for that reason, we believe that the two theories are compatible, that they're consistent, that with more information, it would have even created a higher likelihood that the defendant doctors would have made the right decision instead of the wrong one that they did. Now,
if they had not prescribed Depakote at all, if that's the arguments in this case, would there then be no liability to the doctors for the claim in the Northwestern case that they should have stopped?
Well,
if it had never been prescribed in the first place?
Well, I don't think that that's inconsistent, that that even if we had the same set of facts where they started Mrs. Muhammad on Depakote, that when they had the pregnancy scare, as I mentioned before, there would have been even more reason to stop, because when they had to do their reevaluation of the risk benefit, that the risk of 10 to 17% injury would have tipped the scales at that time as well to stop Depakote and choose an alternative. The doctors would not be insulated. I mean, they were the ones that prescribed Depakote. So they're the ones that would still have had to either choose a different alternative or stop the Depakote. So it wouldn't, the fact that if there had been better warnings, it would not have relieved them of their liability.
Mr. Milo, I'm sorry, if I may, just to follow up on that point, just to be certain that I'm understanding you correctly, is it not the case that in the Northwestern litigation, the Muhammads alleged in their complaint, and I imagine sought to prove, that the warnings that the doctors received in that litigation was sufficient to put them on notice that they should not have prescribed Depakote to a woman in Ms. Muhammad's situation? If that is the case, that that indeed was the allegation, then is there not some conflict in saying that they were sufficiently warned but prescribed Depakote anyway, but now we're arguing that the warnings were insufficient?
Well, I need to clarify one thing, and that is that plaintiff's expert, Dr. Wills, would not offer the opinion that Depakote never should have been given, because at that time there was only a known risk of 1 to 2%, and that if you were doing the risk analysis using 1 to 2%, then it would be reasonable to have started Mrs. Muhammad on Depakote. However, as events unfolded and it became apparent that she could not be trusted to not get pregnant, then even that 1 to 2% risk was enough to tip the balance against Depakote and for the doctors to stop prescribing it. The point I was trying to make is that if Abbott had properly labeled Depakote to say that there was a 10 to 17% chance that a child or a fetus exposed to Depakote would develop cognitive deficits, such as the one that Quattro has, that it would have been even greater incentive, or it would have even further tipped the balance when the pregnancy scare occurred for the doctors at Northwestern to have stopped the Depakote. And also it's our position that if the Depakote warnings had been proper, then the standard of care that would have been applicable in 2005 would have said you can't prescribe Depakote to a woman who is of childbearing age and who can get pregnant. You need to use something different. So it would have amplified the reasons for the doctors to have chosen a different course. So I don't believe that that's inconsistent. I mean, I think the analysis is similar to two cases we cited, the Tongate versus Searle and the Hansen versus Baxter cases. In each of those cases, the plaintiffs were proceeding on the premise, for example, in Tongate, that the doctor had some knowledge, and based on the knowledge he had, he could have made a proper decision. But if Searle had properly given warnings about the vaccine that was given that caused injury, then it would have further provided a further basis for the doctor to have made the right decision and not given the vaccine. And it's similar with Hansen. The doctors there admitted they had some knowledge about the problem with friction connections in central lines, and that they could and should have done something different. But if Baxter had provided proper warnings, then it would have further increased the likelihood that the doctors would have done the right thing and would have not been negligent. So it's the same thing here, that if the proper warnings have been put out, it would have amplified the danger and amplified the reasons for the doctors to have chosen a different course of action. I'd like to also just point out that the Smilas case that was relied upon by defendants is really apples and oranges and does not apply here. In Smilas, the plaintiffs, when they changed experts, actually changed the date of injury. They moved it from August 10th to August 14th for the purpose of making the remaining doctor potentially liable, when under the old theory, he could not have been liable because he did not see the patient before August 10th. So that was a huge change in fact change that was totally inconsistent, which is not the case here. Plaintiff has always been consistent that the injury occurred right after Mrs. Mohammed became pregnant and was due to the exposure to Depakote in the period of time for about 6 weeks until it was stopped.
I don't know if you want to go to proximate cause. Thank you.
Okay. On proximate cause, there are a couple of things. One is that under Illinois law, starting in the Seif versus Ingalls case, when Justice Frassard's dissent saying that if a doctor says, even if I knew I wouldn't have done anything, a treating doctor, that a plaintiff can create a question of fact to defeat summary judgment and go to a jury by having an expert opine that if the doctor had followed the standard of care, that he in fact would have done something different. And that's what we have here. We have the testimony of the two treating doctors from Northwestern who 15 years after the fact, and after testifying initially that they couldn't even remember their thought processes at the time they prescribed Depakote, suddenly are saying that we would not have changed our course of action no matter what. As Justice Frassard pointed out, that such testimony looking back after the fact is really nothing more than rank speculation, and that a more persuasive approach is to look at what a doctor should have done if the information had been provided. And that's what we've done here, is that we have tendered the deposition or the affidavit of Dr. Nasser, who testifies by way of affidavit that if the true risk of Depakote were published of 10 to 17%, then any physician knowing that information would not have prescribed it, because it would have been against the standard of care to give a woman of childbearing age who was sexually active and at risk of becoming pregnant Depakote, especially when safer alternatives were available, such as lithium. And the defendants have contended that that theory was has been developed in medical malpractice cases and should not apply here to product liability cases. However, I would point out that that line of thinking and evidence is consistent with product liability law, that there is a theory in product liability law in warning cases that it's called the heating presumption theory. It was adopted by the court in Marr versus G.D. Searle, and that is, it is presumed that a competent doctor will heed and follow proper warnings. And so all that we're doing here is that we are providing the factual basis of what a competent doctor should have done if in fact they had the information that was that was the correct information about the risk being between 10 and 17%. And so we believe that that testimony overcomes and creates a or creates a question of fact at a minimum regarding proximate cause in this case. And that is if the warnings had been properly given with the proper risk of 10 to 17%, that it would have should have caused the two treating doctors not to prescribe it in the first place. And obviously, if never prescribed, the injury would not have occurred because Mrs. Mohammed would not have been taking Depakote at the time she became pregnant. So we believe that proximate cause is a question of fact and is not a, a proper basis for affirming the court below. So we believe, Your Honors, and ask that the trial court decision granting summary judgment be reversed and that this matter be sent back for further proceedings.
Thank you. Justice Martin, do you have any questions?
No, Justice, no further questions, not at this time.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Whitnour?
Thank you, Justices, and good morning, and may it please the court. Stephanie Whitnour for the appellees, Abbott Laboratories and AbbVie, Inc. In Smilas versus Lipkus, this court made clear that a plaintiff cannot place principal blame for his injuries on one medical professional in one lawsuit, obtain a benefit from that lawsuit, and then turn around and file another lawsuit that tries to tell a different story to place principal blame on someone else. That's exactly what the appellants did here. In the Northwestern case, the plaintiffs claimed that the doctors had the information that they needed to make a safe prescribing decision, but that their failure to use that information resulted in the plaintiff's injuries. In this case, the plaintiffs have done a 180-degree turn. They now claim that the doctors did not have the information that they needed to make a safe prescribing decision because Abbott didn't give them the information and that it was Abbott's fault the plaintiff now has injuries. This is precisely the situation that judicial estoppel was designed to prevent. And there can be no doubt that application of the doctrine here would not be an inequitable remedy. This is not a case of an inadvertent non-disclosure of a bankruptcy asset, which was the case in Seymour. This is not a case where a plaintiff would be left with no recovery if judicial estoppel was applied, which was also the case in Seymour. This is a case where a plaintiff made a strategic choice as to what story to tell to a jury. The jury believed the plaintiff's story, and the plaintiffs walked away with a $12 million voluntary settlement that was based on a jury verdict in their favor. Separately, no pharmaceutical failure to warn case that's reported in Illinois has found a submissible case on causation with the type of doctor testimony we have here, where the doctor said unequivocally that a different or additional warning from Abbott would not have changed their prescribing decision. Either basis, judicial estoppel or proximate cause, independently justifies summary judgment. I want to start with judicial estoppel, though. As Mr. Lundblad said, there are really only two of the five factors of judicial estoppel that are at issue, which is, did the plaintiffs take an inconsistent position in the Northwestern case and in this case? That's what this boils down to. That's the question for this court. Are the positions inconsistent? And I think it's important to look at what the plaintiffs actually alleged and what they actually said in the Northwestern case. In their amended complaint, which is in the record at C-266, the plaintiff specifically said at all relevant times here too, Depakote was well known within the medical and mental health care communities as a drug that could cause serious debilitating birth defects and was well known to be contraindicated in women who could become pregnant. They also alleged in the Northwestern complaint that the doctors continued to prescribe Depakote despite knowledge of the well-documented and widely accepted dangers associated with the use of Depakote. In fact, plaintiffs in the Northwestern case went so far as to file a motion in limine to exclude any reference of their dismissed warnings claims against Abbott so that the jury could not hear about those claims. And I just want to clarify on the record one thing. Our briefing had indicated that the claims against Abbott and Northwestern were at one point in time part of the same lawsuit, but appellants correctly noted that they were part of two different lawsuits that were pending at the same time. In any event, for the legal principle, it makes no difference. They dismissed their claim against Abbott and sought to make sure that the jury didn't hear about that claim. And specifically, Mr. Lundblad represented to the circuit judge in Cook County. He said, if we win this trial, then there will be no need to take further action by way of a warnings claim against Abbott. And he said, the reason for that is because the doctors that are involved in this case, the Northwestern case, they've all testified, if we just had more information, we wouldn't have prescribed the Depakote. They never said that. He said, nobody here said that if we only knew more, we would have acted differently. So essentially, he was telling the circuit court exactly the opposite of what he's told the circuit court in this case. He was telling the circuit court, the doctors never said that they would have done anything differently. So Abbott's warning makes no difference. And they benefited.
Can we take arguments on a motion in limine in which plaintiff's counsel was attempting to argue the relevancy of the dismissed Northwestern suit as being a position which could be judged inconsistent under judicial estoppel?
I think so. I don't think there has to be certainly it does not have to be under oath. The Smalis case made clear that the representations when you're comparing them don't have to be representations under oath. But the bottom line is that he was making those representations consistently. He was saying this is our theory in the case, and that's what he represented to the court. But even setting that aside, I don't think you necessarily need that because we also have the amended complaint, which you clearly can look at in the Northwestern case where plaintiffs are asserting that exact same position, that the doctors had knowledge of the risks and that they shouldn't have prescribed it based on that knowledge.
Before you move on from the judicial estoppel issue, I would also ask you perhaps to comment on the fact that judicial estoppel, it requires that a party offer evidence that they intend the trier of fact to take as evidence. This we're talking about is a hearing with the court, the judge, him or herself, about what evidence to allow, not the plaintiff trying to produce evidence to the trier of fact, which it seems to me judicial estoppel, there's that requirement for judicial estoppel to be effective.
The requirement in judicial estoppel is that the plaintiff took two different paths, had pursued two different litigation theories. There is no requirement that the plaintiffs had to actually tell the jury outright.
But there has to be facts that they intend for the jury to accept or the trier of fact to accept. And this wasn't, this discussion that you're talking about was in the confines of a motion in limine. That's the only point.
I understand. My response to that would be that was a representation made to the court that in any event, the amended complaint is what courts regularly look at when they're comparing whether there's inconsistent theories. And my final response to that would be the question in the Northwestern case you have to ask is why? Why should the doctors not have prescribed Depakote? The only reason how the jury could possibly find that the doctor should not have prescribed Depakote is if they knew of the risks associated with it and prescribed it anyway. That's inconsistent with the theory in this case that the doctors did not know about the risk.
But isn't it that they didn't have as much information and that I believe counsel said it was the risk benefit analysis would have changed?
Yeah, I wrote down exactly what Mr. Lundblad said before this court just a few minutes ago. He said that their claim here is with more information, the doctors would have made the right decision. So said with more information, the doctors would have made the right decision. That is completely inconsistent with the claim that was made in the Northwestern case. I think that we have to ask ourselves if the jury in the Northwestern case had heard that with more information, the doctors would have made the right decision, would they have found the doctors liable? And I think it's undeniable that they could not have. It would have been completely inconsistent. So we don't dispute that there can, in some cases, be more than one proximate cause of the injury, but that's not what was alleged here. Either the doctors had sufficient information, the information that they needed to make the right prescribing decision, or they didn't. And in Northwestern, the theory was that the plaintiffs had sufficient information. Mr. Lundblad didn't discuss this in his oral argument, but I do want to briefly discuss the equities because it was made a big part of plaintiff's brief. And again, the cases that have found that the factors of judicial estoppel were met, but then have refused to apply it, are cases where there was a mistake or an inadvertent failure to disclose something in the first case, and where the plaintiff personal injury victim would be left with no recovery for his injuries. Here, there was a tactical decision made on the part of plaintiffs that they were going to pursue the doctors and that they were going to place the claim on the doctors. It was a tactical decision that paid off for the plaintiffs. The jury accepted their arguments and awarded $18 million, and they walked away with a substantial $12 million recovery. So, and now, in this case, are seeking even more damages and more money for the same injuries based on an alternative and not alternative, but a completely conflicting theory that is different than the one that they pursued in front of Northwestern. So the plaintiffs have been compensated substantially for their injuries. And so this is just not a case where it would be inequitable to apply judicial estoppel.
I think the plaintiff has indicated that, should this proceed and go to a judgment, verdict, whatever, for plaintiff, that Abbott would receive some type of credit or offset for the $12 million. Is that true? And how would that work?
Yeah, so that is true, that if there was a verdict in excess of $12 million, that Abbott would, after the verdict, receive a set off in that amount. However, Abbott would not be able to tell the jury about that. And the plaintiff's decision to accept that settlement in the Northwestern case for $12 million was in acceptance of full recovery for their injuries. The jury verdict was meant to fully compensate them for their injuries. So it would still be a situation where they were allowed to tell the jury one thing in the, we can't go back to the Northwestern trial and tell those jurors, hey, by the way, they're now claiming that Abbott caused this. They've already received their full recovery from that. So the setoff would not, it would still give plaintiffs a second bite at the apple to try to get even more money and roll their dice again and see if they can, you know, get even more money when they've already been fully compensated. I'd like to move on to proximate causation. Judicial estoppel can and should be the end of the inquiry by this court. It was the end of the inquiry by the circuit court, and the circuit court summary judgment order can and should be affirmed on that basis. But even if it's not, and even if we go on and look at proximate cause, it presents a separate and independent basis that this court can affirm on. In a failure to warn case against a manufacturer, the plaintiffs have the burden of proving that a different warning would have made a difference. So in a pharmaceutical case, a prescription drug case where a doctor has to prescribe the drug, the question is whether the prescribing physician would have made a different decision if there had been a different warning. This is not just a case where the plaintiffs don't have sufficient proof on that element or where they don't have any proof. It's a case where the doctor's testimony actually negates proximate causation. Both doctors testified repeatedly and unequivocally that additional or different warnings would not have made a difference to their prescribing decision, because to them, the key was their knowledge that Ms. Muhammad was on birth control. She had a severe condition that required Depakote, and they knew that she was on birth control. So they said, that no matter what the rate of the risk was, that wouldn't have changed their decision to prescribe Depakote to her, since they knew she was on birth control and since she needed the medicine so much. Dr. Allen specifically said, regardless of what the percentage of risk was, I would have still prescribed it. That testimony is key and negates proximate causation. I do want to briefly touch on the heeding presumption, because plaintiffs brought that up in this case. The heeding presumption, first and foremost, has not been adopted by the Illinois Supreme Court or any Illinois court. The case that plaintiffs cite, the 1979 case of Marr versus G.D. Searle, that was actually a case brought under Texas law, and the Illinois Court of Appeals cited a Colorado case for the adoption of the heeding presumption. It's not a presumption that applies in Illinois, but even if Illinois had adopted the heeding presumption, it doesn't apply where you have actual testimony from the doctor. The heeding presumption is about what the doctors would have done if there had been a different warning in the absence of evidence otherwise. Here we have the evidence from the actual doctors about their testimony about what they would have done. So that the presumption not only hasn't been applied in Illinois, but it wouldn't apply to this case anyway. Finally, I'd like to briefly discuss this affidavit that plaintiffs tendered in response to Abbott's summary judgment motion. This is an affidavit from a purported expert witness who opines that a psychiatrist adhering to the standard of care would not have prescribed Depakote in the face of additional warnings. So the affidavit from the doctor says essentially that the doctors here, their testimony violates the standard of care. Their testimony that they would have prescribed it violates the standard of care. And Mr. Lundblad is right. Our argument against that is that these are all medical malpractice cases. Plaintiffs have failed to cite, and there is none, a single product liability case where the plaintiffs can overcome warnings causation by tendering an expert affidavit on standard of care. And that makes sense, because the question in a product liability warnings case is not what the doctors should have done. That's not a question to be asked. The question is what the doctors would have done, what these doctors, not what a good doctor would have done, not what a doctor adhering to the standard of care would have done. That's a medical malpractice question. The question in a product liability case is what these actual doctors, Ms. Muhammad's actual doctors, would have done. And we know from the testimony what they would have done. And that's why plaintiffs haven't found a single case outside of the medical malpractice context, which is obviously much different because the doctors are on trial and standard of care is the question presented to the jury and the court in that case.
But isn't it more evidentiary question? I mean, you obviously are using their testimony from a medical malpractice case in your defense in this product liability case, and they're challenging it or trying to create a question of fact with their affidavit.
To be clear, the testimony that we have cited and all the testimony from the doctors about what they would have done in the face of additional warnings is from this case. The doctors were deposed in this case. They weren't asked those specific questions because it wasn't a warnings case. They weren't asked those specific questions about if there had been a 10% or 20% or whatever.
I'm sorry, you're correct. Yes, I'm sorry.
No, I appreciate the clarification. And
you know, Counsel, let me interrupt you just on this affidavit issue. So then is it your position that Dr. Nazar's affidavit does not raise a material issue of fact when he, in effect, in his affidavit does say that he would, that the doctor should have done something differently?
Yes, it's our position that it doesn't create a material question of fact for this product liability case. I do think it could have created a question of fact as to whether the doctors violated the standard of care. That's not the question here, though. The question here is what the actual doctors would have done. In a standard of care MedMal case, yes, it would potentially create a question of fact. And that's why there are cases in the medical malpractice context that say exactly that, that a expert affidavit on standard of care can raise a question of fact in a standard of care case. But there's no question in this case that's being presented as to whether the doctors violated the standard of care in a product liability case.
But there is a question about whether or not they had sufficient information to make a decision?
That is the question that would be asked is, yes, did they have sufficient information to make a decision? And they answered that question with their testimony. The evidence is that the doctor said, yes, we had sufficient information to make a decision, which is the same theory that the plaintiffs advanced in the Northwestern case. Essentially, just to conclude, the appellants in the Northwestern case proceeded on a theory that the doctors had the information that they needed to make a safe prescribing decision. The jury accepted that premise as true, and appellants benefited substantially to the tune of $12 million. Now in this case, the plaintiffs have alleged and claimed that the doctors did not have the information they needed to make an appropriate and safe prescribing decision, and that if only Abbott had given them more information, the outcome would have been different. Not at all what they alleged in the Northwestern case. The circuit court carefully evaluated the facts and the testimony and correctly held that judicial estoppel applied, and this court should affirm on that basis. But if the court reaches the proximate cause issue, the testimony of the doctors in this case is unequivocal and cannot possibly support a finding that a different warning would have resulted in a different prescribing decision. So under either scenario, the circuit court's ruling was correct, and appellants respectfully request this court affirm.
Thank you. Any further questions, Justice
No,
Martin?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, counsel. And Mr. Lundblom, would you like to offer some rebuttal with the time frame of the 5 minutes?
All right. With regard to the proximate cause issue, going backwards here, the doctors, their testimony, and in particular that of Dr. Allen's, was preposterous. He said that even if he had been told that there would be a 100% chance of serious cognitive handicaps and deficits caused by Depakote if Mrs. Muhammad became pregnant, he would still give the drug. That testimony is unbelievable, and the reason that what makes Dr. Nasser's testimony relevant is that the Marr court specifically talked about the heeding presumption, which has been a competent doctor will heed and follow proper warnings. So this raises a question of what a competent doctor would have done if Abbott had fully disclosed the extent and seriousness and the much higher rate of risk that its drug had for causing severe cognitive deficits if a woman became pregnant while taking it. So I believe that even though the cases such as Seif and Snelson arise in the medical malpractice case, that based on the fact that the warnings and the fact that competent doctors are presumed to follow them makes his testimony relevant. And this was not a small change. I mean, we went from a 1 to 2.2% risk of a serious deficit to a 10 to 17%. And I believe that creates a question of fact as to whether or not it would have been reasonable for the doctors to have done what they did had they known that information. With regard to the question that Justice Martin raised regarding the hearing on an evidentiary motion, as Seymour points out, the movement has to provide clear and convincing evidence. As noted by the court here, there was argument on a motion in limine, and counsel never provided the final ruling on it. The judge indicated in her comments that she was making an interlocutory ruling, and it had to do with the breadth of cross-examination of plaintiff's proximate causation witness, Dr. Siegel. So they've never tendered to this court the actual cross-examination and what the judge did. And it really is an irrelevant issue. And besides that, in the depositions of Dr. Allen and Dr. Stepanski in the Northwestern case, neither attorney asked a hypothetical of what the doctors might have done if they had additional information. So that's why it would have been irrelevant to the Northwestern case to have even gone into it, because there was no basis for it. And the going back again to the differences in this case, the evidence was that because spina bifida is so catastrophic, that even a 1-2% risk should have been enough for Dr. Stepanski and Dr. Allen to stop the Depakote once it became evident that Mrs. Muhammad was not going to be capable of avoiding pregnancy. So, and the point being is that if the doctors had knowledge that it was not just a 1-2% risk, but a 10-17% risk, it's our position that that additional information would have pushed them to make the right decision of stopping the Depakote once the pregnancy scare was acknowledged, or even have not prescribed it at all, which would have been consistent with the standard of care under those set of facts, with that known risk being 10-17%. And I would submit again that those are not factually inconsistent statements, that it's really a difference in legal theories, and the law is very clear that a plaintiff can pursue different legal theories against multiple defendants, and that there can be more than one proximate cause. That in this case, the proximate cause of the injury could have been both the inadequate warnings and the doctor's malpractice. Finally, you know, the with regard to the equities, and yes, the Muhammads did benefit. There was a $12 million settlement, which occurred during jury deliberations. And a cap was put on because there was doubt as to whether or not the jury was going to see it plaintiff's way. And we know from the jury's verdict that $12 million was not full compensation for Quattro and his injuries. And so that the benefit, the plaintiff did not fully benefit and it was not fully compensated, which is the reason for pursuing this lawsuit. And there would not be double recovery because in the event there was a verdict against Abbott that exceeded $12 million, they would be allowed to set off. So I believe that when the equities are looked at in this case, that even if, well, first of all, that on its own, defendants have not proven that judicial estoppel should be applied here. Under the equities, it should not be applied. And with Dr. Nasser's affidavit, there are questions of fact on proximate cause that require a jury to hear them. So we would again ask that this court vacate the summary judgment and remand the case back to the circuit court.
Any questions?
I have a counsel, a 60-second response. Was the doctor's negligence an intervening cause here?
Are you addressing it to me?
I am, sir.
Okay. An intervening cause. No, it was not an intervening cause. It was a combination of, it was I believe that the failure to provide adequate warning and the doctor's mistakes in judgment in evaluating the risk benefit, they were, causes that were working, that would work together in conjunction with each other to reach the result that occurred here. But the doctors would not, their conduct alone would not be an intervening cause that would insulate the drug company from liability. That it would have been a combination of events and causes, not an intervening cause.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
No other question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lundblad and Ms. Whitnauer. We will take this case under advisement.